Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So obviously we'll keep you updated all morning, as will Mike Scott, on the shooting in Boulder, Colorado that left 10 dead, including a police officer. But, you know, unlike most shows, prefer not to have banal conversations full of speculation about things that we don't know and saw sawdust over the same issues that we saw sawdust over with these mass shootings, gun control, and so on and so forth. We'll see how the left tries to turn this into some sort of hate crime or in example of white supremacy somehow. But
yeah, the name's not been released yet of the suspect nor motive.
Right. So let's just take information as it becomes available to have an informed conversation when that is possible. So that's the approach on that matter. On another matter, photographs leaked out from border detention facilities yesterday, including James O'Keefe at Project Veritas doing a flyover of facilities to highlight what the Biden administration doesn't want highlighted clearly, that those pictures that the left was so morally indignant over during the Trump administration of detaining people who tried to come into this country illegally until there could be some legal and humane dispensation of their claims, asylum claims or what have you. It was horrific. Children in cages during the Trump administration. It's we don't want you to see that it's the same situation here, actually worse because of the policies that have incentivized so many unaccompanied minors to be sent across, so many people to otherwise try to get in.
And now they're not in cages. They look like they're in plastic bubbles because of COVID. They put this plastic wrap up in between them, but it's still horrific. And they're overcrowded, 250 in one. It's supposed to hold 250. It's holding 400 children.
Well, is it horrific? I mean, the point here was it was over the top with a moral indignation, with misplaced self-righteousness during the Trump administration. Well, what is border enforcement supposed to do with people trying to get into this country legally? Just set up a turnstile? Or do you detain them 72 hours as provided by law, try to provide more resources to the border in terms of immigration judges to expedite the adjudication of cases and so forth? But is what you saw with the pictures yesterday, is that inhumane, or is that people basically like sleeping in something akin to a barracks until cases can be dispensed with? I mean, again, it's a crisis that the Biden administration has fomented that otherwise didn't need to be as severe as it is. Of course, that's true. That's why they don't want you to see it. But they don't want you to see something that they demagogued in the Trump administration. So is the response for us to demagogue it?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick question. I'll tell you this. My friend that lives right there and works in El Paso said, Amy, they're better in there. It's air conditioned. It's nice. They have a mat to sleep on, a Mylar blanket, and they get fed. Because out there, they're on their own and living, you know, and dirt roads and, you know, in horrible circumstances.
Yeah,
but also, ICE is getting an $87 million contract to secure hotel rooms along the border for families and for children, too. So that'll be nicer situation. And what about the homeless people in Chicago? They don't get that kind of treatment.
Well, that was a question that was put to Jen Psaki yesterday.
That's your girl.
How about comparing the National Guard treatment during their deployment in D.C. to those at the border.
So, also, you are opening up new facilities. One of the options that's being reported over the weekend is spending $86 million on hotel rooms for some migrants and feeding them. How do you square that with the National Guard troops who were sleeping in parking garages and, you know, some of them got sick from having contaminated food? That's a disparity a lot of people are pointing out, that our National Guard was treated one way, and then illegal immigrants are going to be put in hotel rooms.
Well, first, let me say that at the time when we became aware of the conditions National Guard troops were in parking garages, as you noted, the president called the head of the National Guard that day and offered his assistance, offered to play any role that he could play, boosting morale, asking for more aid, making sure they had the right, were treated in the way that they deserved for the incredible role they've played. So I know that was some time ago, but that was the reaction he took at the time.
One more on Rachel Levine. Her confirmation has gotten a lot of opposition from Republicans.
Boosting morale. When Jill Biden came by and gave him little snacks. Remember that when she...
There are foreign objects in your food. Let's get Joe Biden here to do a little soft shoe and boost everybody's morale. You're sleeping in hallways and parking garages. You've got no bullets in your guns. It's all performance art. Let's get Joe Biden in here to tell a couple fabulous stories and boost everybody's morale. Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison, the treatment of people trying to enter this country illegally versus the treatment of our National Guardsmen. Oh, by the way, it's not just $86 million for hotel rooms. The Center for Immigration Studies estimates it's more like $4.4 billion from the $1.9 trillion funny money spend from the Biden administration. $4.38 billion is what they estimate based on 2.65 million illegal immigrants who have Social Security numbers that allow them to receive stimulus checks.
Oh.
Aliens temporarily present without status, according to the director of the research of research for the Center for Immigration Studies. Yeah, they're in the country illegally. They could be required to leave. Yet under their current system, they're still given work authorization and Social Security numbers. So there again, the lack of distinction between people in this country illegally and American citizens. And actually, in the National Guard compare case, those in attempting to get into this country legally being treated better than National Guardsmen, arguably.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. I had a problem with, you know, what about this social distancing? Can't get our kids into school, but you could put 400 people in a room.
Where else in the country would it be okay to have 400 people in a space for 260 during the pandemic?
Well, again, Peter, we're closely following the CDC guidelines. That's why we're opening up additional facilities, why they've been at limited capacity in a number of these shelters.
But if I may, I don't know that there are CDC guidelines that say you can be open.
Are you talking about the shelters or are you talking about the Border Patrol?
Border Patrol facilities.
Apologies, I was misunderstanding your question.
Yes.
Look, I think our objective is to move. This is one of the reasons this is such a focus every single day for the president and this administration. Mm-hmm. We want to move these kids as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. And where they're moving them is to a place in Donna, Texas, that normally holds 400 people, and they have 3,700 kids in there right now.
Well, here's the other thing. I'm sorry, your objective? When did we get in the business of objectives when it comes to social distancing and all the COVID strictures? We don't accept a business owner says, my objective is to at some point comply, but I'm not going to be compliant right now. So why do you get an exemption?
Yeah, you know what? Good point. If you own a business, full capacity.
We have these objectives.
Go.
We have these. No. Aren't you, by your definition, creating super spreader events? By the way, we know based on the number of people who've tested positive, which is estimates from 5 to 50%, that and released into America, that you're not following that protocol either. So now you're creating potential carriers, super spreaders, if you will, to use the favorite phrase of the COVID enthusiasts. You're doing that.
Yeah. Oh, and he asked her.
I don't care what your goal is. Yeah. I don't care what your goal is, some time in the distant future. Today, right now, the government doesn't accept any qualifications from American citizens. Why do you get one, Saki?
So what is his concern about this being a super spreader event where you've got 400 kids stuffed into a pod built for 260?
These kids are tested.
Oh, they are?
If they need to be quarantined, they are quarantined.
Where?
We also follow CDC guidelines to ensure that they are kept safe. One of the reasons that it took us some time to have some of these facilities or some of the shelters open to larger groups of kids is because we wanted to follow those CDC guidelines. So we certainly don't see it through that prism.
I mean, such lies coming out of that woman's mouth.
You just said your objective is to get there. Now you're saying you are there.
Yep.
Which is it? Pick
a story and stick with it. There's no CDC guidelines being followed at any of those shelters.
Peggy in Chicago.
Hi, I have the solution to the immigration problem. Okay, ready for this?
We're ready, Peggy.
The solution to the immigration problem is to take the people that are coming in and ship them to sanctuary cities.
Oh, that's what they're probably going to do.
They have been telling me for years that they're sanctuary cities and people can come there, you know, and it's safe and all that. Why are we putting this all on Texas? I mean, these cities are open, and people can go. And this is their bread, this is their boast and their brag and all that. And I think it would be a swell idea.
Yeah.
And of course, if they decide they don't want to do this, well, maybe they weren't so sincere when they made that boast. And like, sanctuary cities are actually illegal.
Yeah,
but
thanks.
They did it anyway.
Yeah, Peggy.
Peggy,
we got to go. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Good idea. And Lori Lightfoot, we're a welcoming city.
Right.
Okay.
Or are they going to keep them in Texas to try and turn Texas blue?
No. Fire up the welcome wagon, Triple Threat. Fire it up. Has that question been put to her?
I had heard rumblings that 4,000 kids were going to be shipped here.
Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning. You know, during the Trump administration, we had all these whistleblowers coming forward, all these good, ethical people stepping forward. You think that maybe we could round up a couple of those ourselves and maybe present them and see how they get treated, you know, treat them like heroes and present the truth? Mm-hmm. I doubt it. I'm just getting a little sarcasm. Thanks.
I hear it. Thanks for the call, Mike.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. As anticipated, we are talking about Evanston. The brainchild of one Alderman Robin Rue Simmons to be the first city in America to set up an actual reparations fund for black residents was approved last night.
Yeah, 8-1 vote.
Yeah, close call. $400,000 eligible to black households out of the gate. They're hoping to put together $10 million over 10 years to distribute in the form of $25,000 housing grants to eligible black residents.
Yeah, and they can use the money for home repairs or to pay off their mortgage or to put money down on a new home. 16 people have been chosen so far to receive this $25,000 cash payments. The money came from donations, but mostly it's coming from revenue from marijuana sales.
3% tax on the sale of recreational marijuana plus donations, that's right. And so we good then in Evanston? 312-642-5600, Turnkey Depro answer line. 646-36-DA, Turnkey Depro text line. Of course we're not. It is alone not enough, said Alderman Simmons, the sponsor of the measure. We all know that the road to repair and justice in the black community is going to be a generation of work. It's going to be many programs and initiatives and more funding. Right. She was given a glowing profile by the press corps a few weeks ago, and this bubbled up to national attention.
This is my home. It's where I live. I love it. My people are here. This community was redlined historically, and that has come along with damages that continue today. Resources were stripped away from the black community, and that stripped away a sense of place and wealth as well.
We've been doing the work, and the work that we've done has not produced any relief in the racial disparities that we have. And it was appropriate that we do something radically different to make good on the commitment that we've made to the Black community. And reparations was the next thing for us to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. One alderman that was against it was Alderman Cecilia Fleming. She said that this is a housing program rather than reparations. She doesn't like the way that it's labeled. She said, don't tell Black people how to spend their money if you're going to give them money.
Right. So the one vote against it isn't really against it, just to be clear. Of course not.
And it's Sebastian Knowles is who's the president of Evanston Rejects Racist Reparations, otherwise known as ERG, wasn't too happy.
It's a social equity housing program, which we are more than fine with passing if they would like to change the name. For us as members of the Black community, it's completely unacceptable to try to create a reparations program and ship that off to the rest of the nation as reparations and use that as a model with it not being fully fleshed out.
So just like Alderman Fleming, I don't think he's against it. He just doesn't like it should be called a housing program.
Right. When he says social equity housing program, that means he's not against it.
Right.
That means he's an identitarian. He's another race hustler. If somebody uses the word equity, or if somebody puts the word equality on the back of their jerseys during an NCAA game, like your alma mater.
I know. I saw that.
That tells you that they're an identitarian goon that is repeating cant that they've heard from the race hustlers. In point of fact, they either are or are a co-conspirator with the race hustlers. Those are the tell words. The weasel words are always the tell words.
This is why they're doing it.
The city of Evanston did embrace the culture of Jim Crow, and they utilized it in various creative ways of enforcing that without actually putting that into the law books.
Uh-huh. Boy, all those enlightened lakefront leftists, Jim Crow, you say. Northwestern University?
Uh-oh.
Oh, heavens.
My. Didn't you go to school there, Dan?
Ooh. Evanston? Is that a conservative enclave? I live there. I went to Northwestern. I don't remember it being overrun by conservatives. And I'm talking about not just in the last 25 years, but like in the last 150 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm always fascinated by these conversations. Any reckoning for the philosophy of those in charge, the city elders, as well as city officials, for what you say they pursued in terms of policies, the norms of Jim Crow, as you heard that gentleman suggest? Any consideration for the perspective of the people in charge who were perpetuating the norms of Jim Crow, sir? No, question that's never asked. Because what's he going to say? Yeah, people who have the same philosophy I do today. Right? You'd borrow from Eli Steele and his When Jack Became, How Jack Became Black documentary. Are you not, sir, replacing one racial order for another? You are. All right. Let's just call it. Northwestern University, since this is insufficient, and we're obviously going to argue about the terminology, because what is the left if not in the business of redefinition? I got an idea.
What?
How about Northwestern liquidate its assets, starting with its endowment, and participate in the community in which it resides? I mean, Northwestern is just as overrun with identitarian goons as the city of Evanston is overall.
Well, the city council said yesterday that the university refused, following World War II, to provide housing for Black students, including returning Black veterans.
There you go.
They got to pay up.
No, you know what?
Or just give them some.
Black residents of Evanston, take a walk around campus and pick out a building you like. Pick out a dorm you like. It's yours. A residential college you like. It's yours. Throw those privileged, snot-nosed identitarians. Throw them right out. I'm sure they'll be happy, actually, to throw themselves out to show how intellectually consistent and pure they are. They're down with the struggle. all those Evanston undergrads, right? Kick them out. You want to play hoops in Welsh Ryan? It's yours.
Yeah. You want to take
throw,
a bet?
Throw
a
the
seat.
Pigskin around Ryan Field? Go ahead. Take what you want. Northwestern, per that gentleman, racist institution. Needs to be dismantled, doesn't it? Can I get a resolution on that, Alderman Simmons? Larry and Bartlett, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just wonder, that $25,000, that's going to be called income. So are they going to lose about 35% to the feds and to the state?
Well, thanks for the call, Larry. I mean, it is income. It's a grant. It's income, whatever form it takes. I mean, okay. So what? So it's taxed. All right. And then what do we got? Gentleman who lived in Evanston his entire life is supportive, but again, not enough.
The contractor, he said, so it's completely out. He said, you find a lot anywhere in Evanston, and I'll build whatever you want.
Well, when he said that, he meant in the black neighborhoods. It was just the way it was. And as we speak, in 2021, we still have these same types of problems.
Same types of problems as 60 years ago. Hmm.
You have denied me all my 98 years. Hopefully, before I die, I'll see the world change.
And get some reparations.
And get some reparations, right.
Yeah, with all due respect, really, the world hasn't changed in your 98 years on the planet. Evanston hasn't changed. Chicagoland hasn't changed. In 98 years, really. We talked about that when this was first proposed, and you had this profile piece on, I think it was CBS This Morning or whatever. It doesn't even matter which one. They're all the same. But, I just wonder how the left in Evanston.
Which is all of Evanston.
Including Northwestern.
Yeah.
How they want to hold up under this scrutiny, under the standard they otherwise set for others. If you or your institution has any connection to any wrongdoing going back to time immemorial, then you are culpable and you have no moral claim to defend what you have now. And essentially, you should turn things over to the descendants of those who were wronged. So turn it over. Yeah. What to 400,000? 10 million over 10 years, I agree, based on the philosophy of supporters. No. And Northwestern should be right there in the crosshairs with its multi-billion dollar endowment and, gilded paths and on their lakefront property. When is Northwestern visited for a comeuppance?
Considering what they did, refused to provide housing for black students after World War II. I mean,
it's a reckoning that's long overdue, isn't it?
Tina Payton, she lives in the same house in downtown Evanston, Dan, that her black ancestors built in the 1800s. She's upset because she just wants the money to use not for the house. She says reparations are supposed to repair harm to the injured parties. So if you're telling someone what to do with the money, this appears to be a discriminatory practice as well. So now there's already some debate as, with the money, what you can do with the money. But again, the money is supposed to go to home improvements or the mortgage.
Yeah, okay.
Or to buy a new house.
Right. I'm sure that at some point the amount and the flexibility with whatever's provided will satisfy everyone. Of course it won't. I'm less interested in the perpetually aggrieved coming up with new and exciting grievances. I want the left to hold the left accountable to the left standard. And that should be what we're pushing. I want to see Northwestern taken apart. How about that? Burlington, Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to point out that, you know, back in the day when all this steering of populations to stay in one neighborhood was supposedly going on, you know, I don't want this to sound bad, but a lot of the black population wanted to be in the black neighborhoods. That's where their families were. That's where their cousins and extended families were. And they were nice neighborhoods. They were kept up and they were taken care of. Black businesses were in good condition. The parks were nice. The schools were nice. And they weren't necessarily wanting to go in the middle of a white neighborhood. I mean, that's part of the story that's missing here.
Well, sure. Thanks for calling, Mark. Of course. You know, people are clannish when it comes to, you know, people of the same ethnicity,
right,
or race. I mean, you know, Italian immigrants and places like neighborhoods called Little Italy, and Chinese immigrants in places called Chinatown, neighborhoods called Chinatown. I'm not suggesting that should be the case, but I mean, it adds to the richness of any community.
Yeah, it gives character to the city.
Yeah, but I mean, but this is the whole thing. What is your end game, identitarians? I mean, why don't you just say it? Your end game is de facto segregation. We fought this whole fight. The civil rights movement was about ending de jure segregation, so you could usher in de facto segregation, self-segregation? Is that the promise of Brown v. Board of Education? Is that the promise of the 1964 Civil Rights Act? Is to have blacks in one neighborhood and Latinos in another neighborhood and whites in another neighborhood? I thought that we were supposed to be integrated and race was supposed to be less dominant when it came to culture and human interaction, not more dominant. But I mean, I'd like to lay bare the fact that they are promoters of de facto segregation. You know why? Because what they're really promoters of is subjugation based on race. The same way racists from a bygone era were promoters of subjugation, superior, inferior, based on race. Well, that's the same thing going on with identitarians today. New racial order.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you know, the debate about reparations like those in Evanston will mainly be a cultural one, but there is a constitutional piece of this. And C. Boyden Gray, who was a former general counsel of the Reagan-Bush administration, he's been on the show before. He penned a very good letter to Evanston laying out the constitutional problems, the 14th Amendment problems to the program that they've set up, which I'll tweet out at Dan Proft if you want to check that out. Marty in Naperville.
Good morning, great show. Not to kind of quote Reagan, not exactly. The last thing you want to hear is the government knock on your door and say, hi, we're here to help. Can you read the statistics in the black community before the 1964 Act about how unemployment was, et cetera, et cetera, Dan? Again, with the government coming in to help, what that destroyed? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Tim in Woodstock.
Morning, Dan and Amy. You know, it seems to me that the awarding of reparations is usually a legal matter. So there's a judge that looks at what happened and what the fair amount is to pay out. And my question is, who's the judge? You know, who's judging here? But like you asked, and what's the end game? If people really think that Black Americans are going to be satisfied and feel like damage has been done, you know, they're grossly wrong. The reparations are usually awarded by a judge, not a bunch of political hacks.
Thanks for the call, Tim.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The lockdown enthusiasts are always running from one flag to the other. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? So we try to address the arguments that you're hearing within your social circles.
Have you heard that new PSA on the radio with these two lesbian women with children who are like, what should we do now? What can we do more? Because we hear there's new variants. Should we go outside the house? But, I mean, it's just pushing this fear and propaganda. It's, you know, from the government. It's PSA from them. The Centers for Disease Control.
What do we do about the murder hornets?
Yeah.
Got to be afraid of those. The Bill Gates group issued a report yesterday about all sorts of new viruses we may have to combat, like what happens if COVID combines with SARS or MERS.
I mean, doesn't he have anything else to do with his time? He is not a doctor. He should shut his mouth.
Hidden disasters, eye bleeding fever to explosive diarrhea. Bill Gates' group warns of 16 diseases that could spark pandemic after COVID. It's a headline.
Explosive diarrhea? That was the name of your junior high band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you guys were a hit.
Yeah.
Is that a clean up after yourselves? But, you know.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood cover band.
I mean, we killed it
with the reflex.
Can't somebody give Bill Gates a hobby?
But the fear mongering that has been so attended to this and continues to be. And so those who are fear addled or in the business of fear mongering for sort of personal psychic gain or in some cases political gain, perhaps even financial gain. One of the things that is raised is long COVID.
Oh, the long haulers? They're a subculture now, you know.
And so I know a lot of people have been infected and you know, gotten through the illness, which is great. And I know anecdotally of stories of people that have lingering effects, whether it's the taste does not immediately return. Sometimes it's psychological lingering effects. At least these are the stories that I've been told. And I mean, I take them at face value. But there was an interesting piece by Jeremy Devine in the Wall Street Journal, who's the resident psychiatrist at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And he raises the specter that much of what is being reported about long COVID could be psychosomatic. It may exist, but be wildly overstated. Again, things that are politicized. He makes the and why is this? This is important. Number one, because the truth is what we seek. Number two, because you have to understand people's incentives, what they're responding to, and are we misusing scarce resources that could be put to higher and better uses? For example, the National Institute of Health last month announced $1.15 billion initiative to research the prolonged health consequences of COVID-19, which deserves study. But Dr. Devine argues the long COVID is largely an invention of a vocal patient activist group. Legitimizing it with generous funding risk worsening the symptoms the NIH is hoping to treat. The concept of long COVID has a highly unorthodox origin. An online survey. Online survey by Body Politic, which was launched in 2018, describes itself atop its website homepage as a queer feminist wellness collective merging the personal and the political. Oh, gosh, why would we question any work product they produced?
Wow. Okay.
Here's what they did. They did a series of online surveys on persistent symptoms. They issued their first report last May. But as he points out, and I had no idea until I read his piece, I'm sure most people didn't either, many of the survey responses who attributed their symptoms to the aftermath of a COVID-19 infection never had the virus in the first place.
Really?
Of those who self-identified as having persistent symptoms attributed to COVID, and responded to the Body Politic's first survey, not even a quarter had tested positive for the virus. 48% never had testing. 28% tested negative.
Okay.
Body Politic publicized the results of a larger second survey in December 2020. Of the 3,762 respondents, only 600, 16%, tested positive for the virus at any time. So how do they rationalize including people who never had COVID or were not tested? Due to the severe lack of testing available in many areas and the prevalence of false negatives, we do not believe people's experiences with COVID-19 symptoms should be discounted because they did not receive a positive test result, wrote the survey's authors. Okay. Take people at their word. Self-diagnosis. God, what do you need a medical profession for? He goes on to point out this is not the first time this has been done because the incentives are aligned for public health professionals who are, you know, in this case, pro-lockdowners who want to aggrandize their power and get more funding for their particular pet projects or just more funding in general. That's where the incentives are aligned. So, and that's where scientific rigor is the casualty. He writes, the subjugation of scientific rigor to preconceived belief reflects a common dynamic encountered in clinical practice. Patients who struggle with chronic and vague symptoms often vehemently reject a physician's diagnosis that suggests an underlying mental health issue, in part because of the stigma around mental illness and the false belief that psychologically generated symptoms aren't real. And he goes on to provide other examples, including chronic fatigue syndrome being physical and not a mental issue, when the prevailing view among medical practitioners is that it is largely a psychological condition.
Okay.
He writes, the government's about this, a central underlying feature of many psychosomatic symptom disorders is a fixed belief that one is ill and unlikely to recover. By drawing attention to and legitimizing the ever-present threat of long COVID, medical authorities will lead a large group of impressionable patients to believe that their COVID-19 symptoms have not resolved and they are helpless victims of an unrelenting sickness. The NIH's decision is a victory for pseudoscience, will do more harm than help patients. Boy, we hear that a lot. Do more harm than help patients. This is really interesting. I mean, especially because of the stories we've all heard, and that's why I'm interested to get perspective, even anecdotal. And then also, there was a high-profile case just over the weekend. The CEO of Texas Roadhouse who killed himself.
Oh, that's right. Because he had tinnitus ringing in his ear, and he attributed that to COVID.
Well, at least the reporting did.
Right, the reporting did. And, well, he had told his family members that he couldn't take the ringing anymore, and he killed himself.
It's a bizarre case.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing.
And tinnitus, it sucks. I mean, it's not fun, but you learn to live with it, and then eventually you don't know that it's there anymore. But it's, I don't know if it had to do, I've never heard of tinnitus associated with COVID before. That was the first time.
Well, everything traces back to COVID. This is sort of one of the concerns when, you know, all roads lead back to COVID. Just like anything that happens bad in this world, all roads lead back to Trump. Sort of the same sort of flimsy line of argumentation in many instances. And the question is this one of them, long COVID? Confusing a psychological condition with a physical one. Now, again, this is a general statement. You know, if I didn't have taste and I tested positive, I got sick and then I got over the illness, but I haven't regained my taste. Right. That's physical, I suspect. There are other circumstances, the damage that COVID did to somebody's lungs. And so now you have a persistent post-COVID problem. Right. Understood.
And a few people have gotten double lung transplants.
But there are larger, but this is general statements. There are always going to be exceptions. The question here is always one of order of magnitude. Do we really understand the scope of the problem, or is it being completely distorted by fearmongers? That's what we're trying to get at. Nick in Des Moines, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I also read a similar article, and it said that, I'll read it here. It says, the long haulers describe a complex of unremitting chronic symptoms, including palpitations, headaches, severe fatigue, sleeping difficulty, hair loss, and brain fog, which is very interesting because it also overlaps quite a bit with symptoms of depression.
Right.
Which is not unreasonable to think that a lot of people might be depressed in this time, but
You know, that being said, there's no doubt in my mind that there are people who suffer from some really devastating illness and sequelae from their COVID infections, you know, from their lung disease. And it certainly does have some neurological components because people, you know, lose their sense of smell and taste. Like, you know, a guy might experience tinnitus afterwards, but the rate at which they talk about this occurring in people is just unbelievably, like, frankly, exaggerated, in my opinion, compared to what you would see with most other viral infections and, you know, severe complications afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Good comments. Appreciate it. And there's also, you know, other variables that go into this. So, for example, another paper out, this from a researcher at the University of the West of Scotland, looked at social isolation and cognitive ability, cognitive performance.
Oh.
The five time points over 13 weeks, participants age 18 to 72 completed online tasks measuring attention, memory, decision-making, time estimation, and learning. The upshot, social isolation is linked to cognitive decline in the absence of in the absence of aging covariates. But the bottom line is the impact of socialization on cognitive function should be considered when implementing prolonged pandemic-related restrictive conditions. Researchers finding there was subpar cognitive performance associated with social isolation. So that is, again, one of these factors. It's not surprising. It sort of confirms what a lot of people saw, like a parent or grandparent that has dementia, and in isolation, it was exacerbated, for example. So, you know, it's always sort of ceteris paribus, but the you're just trying to have a conversation that gets context into our understanding of this, because the media is completely without context, and so are the, you know, professional lockdowners and COVID enthusiasts. Mark and Gurney.
Good morning. This is Dr. Grouchy. And my biggest concern now is the explosive diarrhea. We may have a run on adult diapers.
Thanks, Dr. Grumpy, or otherwise
Grouchy.
Grouchy. Yeah. Bill Gates. Mm-hmm.
Don and McHenry.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I think you just said something about the general statements and the exceptions. I've always said during this time, we have just gone crazy and managed to the exceptions
right. With
COVID. And the best example I can give to compare it, I don't think it's extreme, is if we change the speed limit to 5 miles an hour, so we would save almost every life that dies from a car accident.
Right. Thanks for the call, Don. Right. Yeah. Anything to save one life, right? Mm. As if they're not trade-offs. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hi, guys. Good morning. The thing is we're not going to know for forever because we're not about the, I have COVID headaches. Supposedly, these are COVID headaches. But when I had COVID, my head felt like it was in a vise and horrible. And are now my headaches stress-related? Are they psychosomatic? No, I feel them. Or are they COVID-related? And the answer is we will not know until there are real long-term studies and we get real stats. And we know we won't get that from the press, you know. And so the answer is we won't know until there are long-term studies to show what has actually happened. So
yeah.
That's my answer.
Thanks.
My comment.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Yeah, the mask mafia gives me a COVID headache.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, by the way, the things per Mary Kay in Western Springs that we're still trying to understand, and it will be a long time before we get a full accounting. Excess deaths, particularly among the young. Good piece by our friend John Tierney over at City Journal about death and lockdowns. Researchers from the University of Illinois, most of the excess deaths among younger people were not linked to the coronavirus 2020.
No.
Among Americans aged 15 to 54, roughly 56,000 excess deaths, of which about 22,000 involved COVID, leaving 34,000 from other cases or other causes. Canadian government also reported essentially especially high mortality among Canadians under 45. Nearly 1,700 excess deaths from May through November, with only 50 of the 1,700 attributed to COVID. Sheldon Jacobson, who's one of the researchers at U of I, we don't know exactly why, but a lot of adults were dying last year who would not have ordinarily died, and it wasn't just because of COVID. It's possible some of the COVID-19 deaths were undercounted, but there were many deaths due to other causes. Shutdown certainly caused mental health issues, and a lot of preventative medical treatments were delayed.
Yeah, nobody went for their screenings. No, women didn't go for their mammograms. I mean, there's just, the list goes on and on about people put off maintenance care for their bodies because of COVID.
So we're starting to get a picture to quantify the impact of lockdowns in terms of producing or inducing death. We still are waiting for the evidence that lockdowns prevented death. Isn't that interesting?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. You could win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and whether or not you believe Joe Biden's pronouncements and the middling rhetoric from his functionaries like DHS Secretary Mayorkas is the proximate cause of the surge at the border, the crisis now at the border. Has that been induced by Joe Biden, or is that just a right-wing talking point? I don't know. Why don't you talk to the people that are coming here? Martha Raddatz did. Part of the right-wing, fast right-wing conspiracy? I don't think so. Martha Raddatz, ABC News, she went on the border to talk to migrants trying to make their way into this country. Here's her conversation with one Brazilian gentleman.
Would you have tried to do this when Donald Trump was president?
Definitely not. Definitely. We had the chance, you know, the same violence that is going on today was there last year. We used to watch the news and... I definitely won't do this.
So did you come here because Joe Biden was elected president?
Basically. The main thing was the violence in my country. And the second thing, I think, was Joe Biden. It's like lighting up my hope. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think we do. And I don't blame that gentleman for wanting to come to a place that's better for him or his family. Never really about people who genuinely want to get into this country because either they're fleeing violence or they just want a better life. It doesn't mean that's, especially the latter, is a legitimate basis on which to gain entrance. And doing so illegally is not a legitimate basis by which to enter. But I understand the sentiment. And it's pretty straightforward. I don't think Martha Raddatz was trying to induce that statement.
No, it was true. And it's not only people from Brazil, but this woman with her three kids. As soon as he became president, they packed up and they started heading on their 20-plus day journey to the United States.
What do you think of President Biden? ¿Qué piensas de Presidente Biden?
Eso espero que nos ayude.
This woman told us she hoped President Biden would help them.
So when she gets to the border now, they're not accepting family. She's like, whoa. They didn't know that that was part of the plan. So now she's deciding whether or not to just drop off her kids and head back herself. So that they can have a better life. And eventually they will reunite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. President Trump was on a podcast with Lisa Booth, Fox News. Not terribly interesting, actually. He did offer a reminder of something he did with Northern Triangle countries in terms of stopping the flow of people fleeing places like Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras.
So one of the things I did was it was impossible to bring them back to Guatemala, Honduras, and San Salvador. And you couldn't bring them back. You couldn't get them back no matter what. And what happened is I said, look, how much money do we pay? We paid those countries $500 million a year. I stopped payment. And all of a sudden, they took them back. In other words, we'd capture MS-13. And if you take a look at El Salvador as an example, or any of them, and other countries too, they wouldn't take them back. So I stopped payment. As soon as I stopped payment, they gladly took them back. Nobody's ever done that before.
Mm-hmm. Incentives matter. And by the way, this is consistent with what we heard from the El Salvadoran president last week in his interview with Tucker Carlson, where he's like, yeah, those, you know, the left is, he didn't say it this way, but it's essentially the takeaway. The left is always talking about, you know, people hardworking, trying to come to America and make a better life. Right. Well, I want hardworking El Salvadorans to stay in El Salvador and make a better life for themselves and a better life and a better environment for El Salvador. That's my job. My job is to provide for El Salvadoran families. And so I don't want them to leave. I'm trying to, he didn't say this, but it's like I'm trying to make El Salvador great again, and the United States won't let me. That's the posture of this administration, was a 180 from the previous. For more on this, let's speak to a official from the previous administration. He is Chad Wolf, former acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and a Heritage Foundation visiting fellow. Chad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
So what about comments we're getting from those migrants making their way to the border? Well, I'm here because Joe Biden and the Biden administration's policies and pronouncements have given me hope that I can get in.
Yeah, this really isn't all that difficult. I think if you just see the messaging, not only the messaging, but the actual policies taken since Inauguration Day, it's very clear why there's a crisis. It's very clear why thousands of individuals are coming to that border because they vote with their feet. And all they have to know and hear is that a friend or relative or someone else has gotten across into the country and is staying here. And if that's what they hear at the end of the day, they will continue to come. We will continue to have a surge and a crisis until you find a way to stop the illegal activity and hold people accountable. This will continue.
But what about, I mean, the mixed messaging, obviously, but you have moms now that are about to give up their kids so that their kids could become American citizens, get into this country, and then they'll go back.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most dangerous things is the surge of unaccompanied alien children, UACs, at the moment. And what we know is a lot of them don't make this journey on, you know, by themselves. The families sometimes make it with them. And then shortly before the border, they separate themselves knowing that the child will get in, but perhaps the family member will not. So the policy that the Biden administration has taken, which is allowing all alien children to come in, regardless of whether they have asylum claims or not, is actually a very inhumane policy because it's providing hope and it's sending a signal it's okay to separate your children. We should be delivering the exact opposite message at the end of the day.
How did you respond to the pictures from border facilities that were leaked yesterday? The sort of pictures that the left had a core meltdown over a few years ago and now won't even address, pretend like they don't exist. And of course, DHS Secretary Mayorkas and Jen Psaki are doing their best to stave off the press from access.
Yeah. So my heart breaks for the CBP, the frontline officers on the ground along that southwest border. They're doing the very best that they can. Unfortunately, decisions are being made higher than them at the leadership level, both at the department and at the White House, that are putting CBP officers in untenable situations. They have very few resources to accommodate these folks, but are doing the best that they can. But you're exactly right. If this was 2019 and those pictures out, we had Democratic members of Congress camped out at Border Patrol stations along that southwest border. I think only one or two members of Congress have visited now. So the hypocrisy is very thick these days. The same things that they were outraged in 2009, they are very silent here in 2021. And we know why. It's politics, and it's unfortunate that we are playing politics, not only with border security, but at the end of the day, this is national security, because we know embedded in this flow of individuals, criminals, and sometimes known or suspected terrorists as well. So This is much more than just politics. This is about border security and national security.
Well, not to mention, as you well know, those who are infected with COVID who've been released or those who are in situations like those facilities where you could have some infected with not infected and spread the virus and so forth. And it just runs afoul. I mean, not that this is existential, but it just runs afoul of all of the moral indignation and the hand-wringing about COVID policy you get from this administration, what we see at the border.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. There's no consistent message coming from the administration, particularly on the COVID piece that you just mentioned, but also on the Title 42 piece, which is that public health order that they're turning around single adults. They're not turning around, or I should say, they're only turning around about half of families, and then they're not turning around minors at all under that public health authority. So they're very inconsistent, while at the same time, if you're a Mexican minor, they're turning you around immediately. So they have there's a lot of holes in their approach to this border security crisis. And again, I don't see it getting better anytime soon.
And Chad, what about ICE getting this $86 million contract to secure hotel rooms for families? Has that ever happened before?
So in 2020, we utilized a small number of hotel rooms. We utilized them in a very different way. We were trying to stage individuals close to airports where we could remove them as we were removing them. So if we picked up an individual on a Monday, but we didn't have a flight going out till Wednesday, then we would house them in a hotel close to that airport so that we could get them aboard that flight and then send them back to their home country. The current administration is using those hotels very differently, as you know. They are putting them up in hotel rooms so that they can then release them into the interior of the country. These are two very different things. And I would say a lot of these facilities, whether it's hotels or even some of the soft-sided facilities, don't have any national standards, are not regulated. So understanding that they need facilities, I would encourage the administration to look at already contracted facilities that have standards of care, that have medical services and other things, if you have to do that. I'm not saying that you need to. But if you need to do that, then you need to make sure that some of these facilities have some standards.
And it also seems to me that we need to be precise with our moral panicking in a way that the left is not. So we can suggest that Joe Biden is giving people false hope and he's endangering children who and families who are turning their children over to drug cartels to traffic them into this country. It's concerning when the cartels refer to the president of the United States as the migrant president, as Obrador has suggested. But a lot of the personnel that do the day-to-day implementation of policy are the same personnel that were in the Trump administration. And the point here is to try to enlighten the those living in darkness that people coming here by our frontline personnel were treated humanely during the Trump administration and are treated humanely in the Biden administration. The frontline personnel that are managing those facilities, that are protecting the border, attempting to protect the border, you know, they're not exploiting these people. They weren't exploiting these people then, and they're not exploiting these people now, even if the pictures are distressing. As we a good interplay with Saki yesterday, they're getting treated better at those facilities than the National Guard did in D.C.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the frontline officers know their job. They do their job well. In the case of Border Patrol, they simply don't have the facilities to house the over 5,000 minors that they have in custody. We got to remember that most of these minors, 75% of them, are between the ages of 15 and 17. So these are not small children. These are young adults, and some of them can be very, very dangerous. But they're doing their very best. But what I will tell you is that there's a lot of concern inside Customs and Border Protection. And particularly the U.S. Border Patrol, they see their leadership go out on TV. They see their leadership say that the border is closed, that it's secure, when the exact opposite is occurring. So I do believe that you're having a confidence with the frontline workforce, with leadership, both at the department and the White House. Today, that's very dangerous, and that's something certainly to watch.
He is Chad Wolf, former Department of Homeland Security Acting Secretary and now Heritage Foundation Visiting Fellow. Chad, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, let's gather around. A day in the life of a student at one of these K through 8, in this case, indoctrination centers, masquerading as places of learning. This is a video posted by a Chicago teacher. I've been able to nail down her school yet, so if anybody knows her, feel free to call in. I want to give credit where credit's due.
Yeah, 312-642-5600.
Her name is Katie Hevener. She's a second grade teacher. I know this from other videos she posted online that I watched. The ABCs of woke propaganda. Do you want to know them? You're in luck. She's got a book. A is for activist. Have your kids been exposed to this? A is for activist. A book she's going to read by Innocento Nagara. You ready to learn your ABCs?
All over again? Yes.
A is for activist, advocate, abolitionist, ally, actively answering a call to action. Are you an activist? B is for banner, bobbing in the sky, billowing in the breeze, because you're not shy. C is for co-op, cooperating cultures, creative counter to corporate vultures. O and cats. Can you find the cats? So let's talk about these pages real quickly. Activist is someone who speaks up for what they believe in. An advocate is someone who speaks up for other people's rights and tries to help other people. An abolitionist is someone who wants something to end. So historically in our country, an abolitionist was someone who wanted slavery to end, but maybe you want another bad practice to end too, something you know is wrong, and you want to abolish that. Abolish means get rid of. Ally means a friend and helper. So you can be an ally by showing up to marches and protests. So even though you might not be the one getting harmed, you can still show that you support other people. A banner can send a message to people. So you see a banner behind me that says Black Lives Matter with a heart. That's sending a message to people. I'm going to encourage all of you at the end of this to make your own banner, but we'll wait until then for directions.
Fun.
Oh, yay.
Co-op or cooperating means working together. So cultures that work together would be cooperating cultures. And corporate vultures. So a vulture is a type of bird that waits for an animal to die, and then it swoops in and it eats the dead carcass or the dead body. And what this is saying is that some corporations, really big corporations or big businesses that make millions and billions and billions of dollars, and lots of times they don't treat their employees very well. They keep all the money for themselves and only give their employees just a little bit, or they don't take care of their health sometimes. So what they're saying is that these corporations are kind of acting like vultures when it comes to money. They're being really greedy.
A is for activist, B is for banner, C is for cooperating to abolish corporate vultures.
What happened to A is for apple, B is for boy, C is for cookie?
Gone
are those innocent days. Now they're shoving their political propaganda down your throat.
E?
Uh-oh.
Oh. More than voting, you'll agree. Dictators detest it. Donkeys don't get it. But you and me, we demand equality.
There it is.
Equal rights, black, brown, or white. Clean and healthy is a right. Every place we live and play, environmental justice is the way.
Oh.
D is for democracy and E is for environmental justice.
Environmental justice?
Oh. F.
F is for feminist, for fairness in our pay, for freedom to flourish and choose our own way.
L.
F is for LGBTQ.
Of course.
Love who you choose, because love is true. Liberate your notions of limited emotions. Celebrate with pride our links of devotions. I really like this page.
Yeah.
So LGBTQ means
rhymes.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer, or questioning. And that just means that people can, one, they can feel
whatever gender they feel like and they identify as, they can be that way. No one has to tell them, oh, you're a boy or you're a girl or you have to be this or that. That's up to them. And also, this is saying that just because you're a girl or a boy or non-binary or transgender doesn't mean that you also have to be attracted to and like just boys or just girls, just people that are different from you. It's saying that you can love who you choose, even if they're the same or if they're different. And I think that's really, really beautiful. It says, liberate your notions of limited emotions. So a lot of us have been raised to believe that the only kind of good relationships or right relationships are relationships between boys and girls. But as we're growing and learning together as a society and a community, we're learning that's not exactly true. There's nothing wrong with that either, but that's not the only way to be. So we have to open our minds and liberate ourselves from our former limited emotions.
Liberate ourselves from our former limited emotions. This is a second grade school teacher reading a children's book, obviously, that I think rivals Rules for Radicals or Mao's Little Red Book. Why? Because it targets kids in first, second, third grade. Oh, you want me to go on just in case it's unclear?
Yeah. I want to know how it ends.
M is for...
Masculinity? No, just kidding.
Maybe toxic masculinity, but no. No, M is for... Oh, it's a day we celebrate here in Chicago.
Martin Luther King?
No.
Think
activist, meaning radical, meaning apparatchik, meaning communist.
Megaphones marching, movimiento, music, hip, hip, hooray. It must be May Day.
May Day.
So megaphones and marching. Wow, check this out. The people are in the street making their voices heard. They have banners. They've got music. They've got their megaphones. I see a little kitty cat down here joining.
Oh,
cat.
Mew, mew.
M is for May Day meowing.
Would you like a cup of milk?
Do you know how insidious this is, though?
This is,
I mean, do you appreciate how insidious this is? Does anybody know this book, A is for Activists? Have your kids been exposed to it in second grade in the CPS school or some other awful school in the region? I bet they have. N
is for no. No, no, no. Yes to what we want. No to what must go. No, no, no. And this says no justice, no peace, no war. So if you feel like you're not being treated just, that means you got to speak up and be loud and proud about it and let your feelings be known.
No justice, no peace. So, N is for... And M should be for Maxine Waters, I guess, to compliment N. R?
Radicalized.
No.
R
is for not protesters, but...
Rioters.
Radical Reds, the headline said, ruinous rioters, the rumors spread, rabble-rousing riffraff. Really? So this page is talking about, like, in the news, you might hear a lot about, like, riots and glass being smashed or cars being set on fire or something like that. That stuff does happen sometimes, and that's part of protests because people are really angry about what's going on, and they feel like they're not being listened to.
No one heard
If
me.
You're not listened to, then you get to riot. That's just part of protesting, you know, the mostly peaceful protests.
Mm-hmm.
For second graders. What's S for? S? You're not properly indoctrinated. This should be,
should just
second
roll off
skin.
The tongue.
That's okay. Right. S is for solar power.
Oh.
It's time to talk energy policy with second graders.
Woo!
S is for sun, sol, solar. Superstar stellar power fuels all life, not just flowers. Energized homes, cars, and showers. Silly, selfish scoundrels sucking on dinosaur sludge. Boo. Hiss. So for this one, it's saying that the sun is our best source of power.
Fun.
So you can move to electric power or you can, like, solar power. and collect all your power from the sun, just like plants do. So it's not just for the plants, it can be for us too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of our power right now comes from gasoline. And gasoline comes from the earth. Ooh. And basically what that is very, very, very old dinosaur bones that have been mashed down and turned into sludge that turns into oil. And that oil is what we put in our cars, and we use it to fuel a lot of things in our country. And so this page is saying, instead of using all that stuff that's in the ground that's going to run out pretty soon, we could just use the sun, because the sun's not going to run out.
She does a great Jacobs impersonation from Airplane. First, the dinosaurs came, but they got too big and fat, and they died. And then Arabs started buying Mercedes Benzes, and then Prince Charles started wearing Princess Di's clothes. And the sun, yeah,
it's warm.
All sing songy. What's you for? Had enough yet? You? What's it for? Call it. You. How many words start with you?
Not a lot. Unions.
Bingo.
U is for union. Union, yes. So unions are groups of workers that organize, so they can make sure they're protected in the workplace.
Of course. Yeah.
That's a very generous definition of unions, I think. But, of course, these are generous times. X is for Malcolm.
X is for Malcolm. As in Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm. Y is for your truth.
Y is for you and youth, your planet, your rights, your future, your truth.
And Z, to close out the alphabet, for those of you playing along at home, this is a tough one. I didn't see this one coming. It's good, though. It's good to shoehorn one more appeal to apparatchikdom to close it out.
Z is for Zapatista. Course. And a Zapatista is somebody who is a liberation fighter or a freedom fighter for indigenous rights in Mexico.
Katie Hevener is her name. Chicago school teacher, second grade, trying to confirm the school that she teaches at. And I'm sure she's not the only one. She's just the only one who posted, at least that I've seen, who's posted this read-along, AS for Activists. Starting to get an understanding of what we've been talking about for, lo, these many years, about the state of K-12 education. Rob in Ukrainian Village.
As I'm driving my SUV that's sucking up dinosaur bones, noticing the... and I saw yesterday the article about the radical they had speak in Naperville. It completely reaffirms, as a parent of a second grader, that goes to a I'm very happy with our choice to send them to Chicago Catholic School, that my children will absolutely never see the inside of a public school as long as we live in this area. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. Dave and Gurney.
Yeah, these same people that... are writing this tripe, they're eliminating Dr. Seuss, and that actually read like Dr. Seuss. Don't forget that the radical left wanted to break up the nuclear family, and this is exactly the way they do it.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning. I got one for you.
Yeah.
F is for fracked.
Fracked.
Because if we don't push back on this now, it's over. Society, culture is over. It's interesting she gets Malcolm X wrong, because he had a conversion late in life that ultimately led him to stand up, and he was assassinated.
Greg, I mean, you're talking about someone who thinks we can power our economy with solar power. So, I mean, let's, lower the bar here for Ms. Hevener. But anyway, go ahead.
To use children in this manner is sickening,
isn't it? It should be. Thanks for the call, Greg. That's what I'm saying. You know how insidious this is in that sing-songy voice? It's something from a dystopian novel. She is a ghastly, ghastly person.
And we still don't know what school she teaches
at. And these people are despicable. You think they, because they smile frack you, that they're, well-intended? These are bad people. Second graders. Okay. Margarita in Rogers Park.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I am a teacher as well.
Okay.
For CPS, and I left the union after all this nonsense.
Good for you.
Bless you. Thank you. Thank you. I am appalled to listen to what you just played. My boys attend. I have two boys who attend CPS, and we were just over the weekend looking at other options because this is appalling.
What grade do you teach?
I teach middle school.
Have you heard or seen this AS for Activists book circulating?
I have not, but I'm going to now look into it. It is ridiculous. Yes. I teach middle school. I'm a diverse learner teacher. So I teach several grade levels with middle school. But this is disgusting what they're doing. And I see it in the classroom because I co-teach with other teachers. So I see it and I have to stop it when it's happening. People try to push their agendas onto the students.
Right.
So I see it happening. And I have to stop it and remind my coworkers that that's not what we're here to do.
Good.
We're not here to push our agenda.
Good for you. Wish there were more of you in that system.
And how's your hybrid learning going?
I'm really happy to be back in the building. Unfortunately, we don't have as many students right now. I'm hoping that the fourth quarter brings us more students.
Do you have a handful?
I have a handful of students right now. Hopefully we'll have more in front of us. But the students that we have are happy to be here.
Good.
Thanks for the call, Margarita.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, call in anytime.
Good perspective there. Yeah. Joe in Tinley Park.
I guess Nick Naylor was right. Everybody has a mortgage.
Right. Thanks for the call, Joe. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Shayna. They bought their tickets. They knew what they were getting into. I say, let them crash.
An airplane reference.
I got it.
And
yes,
I'll tell you, you know what? Unless we start electing better people to our school boards, that's what we deserve in some respects. Really.
Well, elections are April 6th. Yep, April 6th. Do not forget to vote.
Thanks for the call, Frank. And Frank's a school teacher as well. Yep. History teacher and
an actor,
a
thespian,
sort of amateur impressionist. Chuck and Delavan.
I was never a school teacher, but the school teachers used to swat me. I had a total of from sixth grade to graduate in high school. I had 79 of them. But F is for farmers, and F is for food, and I think that all farmers shouldn't raise any food this year, which will lead to M, mayhem, and S, starving, and then D, death for people that are like this, that can't raise their own food. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your alphabet, Chuck. Woo.
They bought their tickets. They knew what they were getting into.
Pretty good impersonation, actually.
I say, let them crash.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. Moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Sticking on our conversations, time for our weekly hit with Ted Dabrowski Wire Points and bridging from our A is for Activist re-education about the alphabet. This message from a teacher in District 203, that's Naperville.
Oh, yes.
And this dovetails nicely with what you just heard. During the break from Jeannie Ives in her Breakthrough Ideas commentary. Mm-hmm. By the way, Naperville School District 203 paid Dina Nicole Simmons $10,500 for her 60-minute Zoom keynote address at its 2021 Equity Institute.
Oh.
It's $175 a minute. It's good, good work if you can get it.
Yeah.
Being a race hustler, especially when you have people like that despicable Dan Bridges, the superintendent there. Grotesque figure. But, you know, grotesque school board members, many grotesque parents. I guess it all fits. Thank you for reporting on District 203 anti-racist training. Conservatives that teach here, like me, are disgusted with the direction this district is heading in. I've taught 34 years, most of them in 203. I can tell you that minority students who land in our district have hit the jackpot. There is not a more kind, generous, loving bunch of teachers anywhere who continually bend over backwards to try and close the skills gap seen in many of our students. It's insulting to have to sit through training where we are being told we are racist. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is nothing more than a political agenda being pushed through by the current administration in Washington. Glad I'm retiring this year. Teacher in Naperville, District 203, who shall remain nameless, for fear of being accosted by those despicable people I just mentioned. For more on K through 12 education in Illinois, particularly as the scholarship program animated by the tax credits passed several years ago is under assault by Jelly Belly, the same way a buffet line is, we're pleased to be joined again, as I said, by Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. How are you guys doing?
Good. So the culturally responsive teaching standards just sort of piling on to what's already going on in K through 12 school systems around the state, particularly in Chicagoland, including in the suburbs. And so it seems to me that the pitch battle, the real opportunity for something positive or to retain something positive is to fight to maintain that tax credit scholarship at its current levels, right?
Well, that's right, and actually to grow it.
Yes,
you know it's become very obvious. It's become very obvious during this COVID that maybe that's the silver lining. You hate to look for silver linings in something like the pandemic, but the fact is that I think people around the state, in particular in Illinois, are realizing the power of the unions, the power of the administrations, right? Both of them, they're an oligopoly, right? They work together all the time to push their agenda, and much of that was keeping schools closed. And another big part of that is adding more and more of what you're talking about to the curriculum, just basically watering down the curriculum. So you've got to think that this is a watershed moment for the school choice movement. And the question is, will people organize and demand more or not? And but certainly being locked out of schools for so long and then watching the kind of movements that are happening, like the one by Dan Bridges, you've got to think that we've got to expand our school choice options, or people will do it anyway in some way, maybe by leaving the state.
And we know they're doing that.
Right. And I mean, what's your handle on where the tax credit scholarship fight currently stands?
I don't have a good finger on it, but I can tell you this, that they're going to be attacking it like crazy. The fact that this thing even got on there under Rauner is an amazing thing. And the fact that it survived this long is amazing as well. But this is going to be under massive attack. And, how they managed to keep it is going to be a question of whether, and you're seeing more and more of the black community, the minority community, demand more of it. So the question is can the minority legislators speak up enough to keep it alive and hopefully not see it reduced even more from where it was before?
Well, and that's really a clarion call for their constituents to speak up, to put pressure on them. I mean, that's the thing about these school choice programs. They build constituencies because they provide opportunities. And we've seen this play out in Arizona and Florida and Milwaukee and Wisconsin, Indiana. And so that's what needs to happen here is people who are happy that their child is now accessing a better education because of the scholarships, they need to be heard loud and clear from those in public office.
Well, Dan, it's a battle of messaging, right? Because, we know the media controls everything. The political elite control everything. But now what's interesting is that a lot of the minority community saying, I want my kids in school. And, especially I've worked a lot with the Latino community in terms of school choice, and they like the Catholic schools and the religious schools, and so they're going to hear things from the media, the political elite that goes against what they're thinking, and so I think this could be a pretty good moment for the school choice movement. But again, it's a matter of organization and just how well our side messages that there needs to be more choices.
Now, recently, Wire Points wrote an article about lockdowns and how we compare to Florida. Do you want to tell us what that's all about?
Well, I am actually in Florida as we speak, and it's fascinating.
Are you returning or no?
I'm returning.
Oh, okay.
I'm just intelligence gathering.
Yes.
Since I came down here, the day I arrived, I turned on the TV, and that was the day that Governor DeSantis was pushing against the critical race theory in classes. So tying that conversation, he's saying we're not going to push policies that haven't been vetted into our system. And at the same time, the place is open, and they've come to the realization that they've been at the realization that opening the economy is overall better than keeping it shut, something that we haven't done in Illinois. But there's 20% fewer deaths in Florida than in Illinois over the whole pandemic. Hmm. And that's despite having much looser, lockdown rules.
Well, it starts with first principles. And Ron DeSantis has made clear what the first principle is in Florida, which is that you have a right to be employed or run a business. You have a right to work, essentially,
to go to school.
As it is. And you have a right to go to school. And when you start from there, you generate very different policies than when you start from someplace else, like in Illinois, where you have a right to everything other than those two things, except and only when the government gives you the green light.
Well, that's number one. And there's two angles to this. The one you said is absolutely correct. But the other one is, if we shut everything down, what happens to lives and livelihoods? And there's another math or another science being calculated in Florida that you hurt people when you keep them out of schools, when you keep them out of their jobs, and you hurt people's lives when they can't get their mammogram checks or whatever cancer screenings they need. You hurt people's lives when you put more people into poverty. There's a lot of other science the other side of science is totally ignored in Illinois, where places like Florida actually consider those things, especially since it's minorities and low-income workers who get hit the most when you get these shutdowns, right? You look at the whole restaurant and bar sector. Illinois is the sixth worst in the country when it comes to job losses in that sector. And, that's a lot of low-income people that are getting whacked by being shut out of the economy.
Well, right. There's a good piece in the Wall Street Journal by University of Central Florida professor, actually, who's also at the Cato Institute. Services are where the trade action is. And he reminds that the U.S. is primarily a service economy. Services account for 79% of GDP, 82% of jobs. They constitute only 33% of all exports. But as the lines between manufacturing and services blur, there is more upside to service sector, quote unquote, service sector jobs. This is where the action is, and this is where some focus should be upon reopening.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a slam dunk. Anybody who goes out and eats all the time sees who's working at these jobs. And, we all enjoy going out and using the services in our country. So what we did, we actually ran the numbers from a year ago from January to January, which are the latest numbers. And Illinois has lost 34% of its of those jobs. 215,000 jobs are gone. And so you're talking about a major displacement. These are probably the same families whose kids aren't in school because CPS has been shut down. It's a disaster. And I think our big failure on our side is our inability to message that and to make sure that the science and data of lockdowns was more destructive than the lives lost in COVID.
Well, messages require messengers. And that's what we lack in this state, it seems to me, present company excluded, but that's just not enough. Your colleague over at Wire Points, Mark Glennon, wrote a really interesting piece about how the $1.9 trillion in funny money spend that was recently approved is really a massive federalization play, flood state and local governments with federal dollars, and then come the strings and the mandates and so forth. And so, replacing all those service sector jobs that you just described with just more government largesse in Illinois, where, you know, government is our main industry in this state. We're already a state that has more government jobs than manufacturing jobs. Might as well codify it with some federal help.
Yeah, this is, I think, you know, Mark's piece is a very important piece, because I don't think people are seeing it the right way. You know, again, we're back to messaging, and you know, Biden and others will message this as COVID relief. But if you know, we've run the numbers at Wirepoints. We did a report back a couple months ago how most states have managed to hold even in 2020, calendar 2020 versus 2019, and so they really don't need, you know, the 1.9 trillion more. But if you look behind the movement here of sending this money to states and cities, is, hey, let's get the money there. Let's spend it on the agenda that guys like Biden and Harris have, and let's see if we can make it permanent. Because, you know, once you start spending money on things like child tax credits and things like that, it's really hard to take away the following year.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, right? Yeah, but you build a constituency around that benefit. And yet the left is so good at doing that, and we mm-hmm. struggle so much to build a constituency around a benefit, the tax credit scholarship program we were just talking about, because they constantly trumpet their government-centric insights and benefits, right? And we can't get the whatever constitutes a Republican Party or just center-right people to speak with one voice on something as much of a slam dunk winner as providing choice for people that don't have choice in K through 12 education. It's remarkable.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, to bring this back to Illinois, you still don't see the voices. You're starting to hear a few Republicans start to speak up on some things, but it's not done with the strength and the conviction that's needed. I think, you know, the Republicans have lost so many seats that they're cautious to speak strongly for the fear of losing more. But that what I argue is that perpetuates even more losses.
I have nothing to lose. They have nothing to lose. I mean, except, you know, my little seat, and that's what they really care about. I mean, it's such a tell. Right. I'm risk averse, and I have nothing to protect. It's remarkable.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you think about school choice, it'd be awesome to hear a very strong voice. It doesn't matter. Frankly, I don't care what side, right? It should be,
yes.
It should be the Black caucus and those who support it, or from the Latino caucus with whatever Republicans want to join in. It should be a very firm, strong voice. But no, you don't hear it.
All right. Since I'm, you know, always such a nattering nabob of negativism regarding the great state of Illinois, the land of Lincoln, for at least the next 5 minutes. Anything positive that you want to punctuate so that it's not all doom and gloom?
Are you okay there, Dan?
No, I mean, right. For Ted, not for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, Dan's, you know, willing to listen a little bit. First of all, look, the COVID data is fantastic, right? So we have somebody who doesn't want to listen to the COVID data, but I think that's a place where there might be more and more pressure on Governor Pritzker. But when you got this collapse in the numbers, and you see what's happening in like places like Florida, places opening up, it's great. And now what we just have to do is continue the pressure. Pritzker's going to try to keep his, you know, additional phases and things like that, but I don't think it's going to work. I think he's going to have to buckle. Not only that, if he's planning re-election, he's got to open up more. So that's one piece of good news. It's a bridge.
Okay.
The other good news is really not good news, so maybe I shouldn't say it, but
bring it on.
In Illinois, even the good news is bad news.
Hey-oh!
All right, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, when the federal government floods us with money, you know, mm-hmm. you got Pritzker and Harmon saying we don't need a progressive tax hike right now. So
right
the good
now.
News is no tax hikes, but that may not last long if we can't change things.
Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks as always. Enjoy sunny Florida.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our Turnkey Top Pro Answer Line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and just updating our segment from last hour that Chicago second grade school teacher who read that Maoist book, A is for Activist, the Maoist Alphabet. And as disquieting as the children's book is, her sing-songy read and explanations even more.
Yeah, telling the kids
horrific.
Early on that unions are the only way to go.
Yeah.
And more.
She apparently is at Polaris Charter Academy in Humboldt Park. That's where she teaches second grade. Huh. Just so you know. Again, she posted the YouTube video reading the children's book for, you know, as an instructional for K through second grade. So she made herself public, and we're just highlighting it for her, trying to be helpful. President Trump, in that extended interview he gave to Lisa Booth for her inaugural podcast, had some interesting comments about the Jacobin left in this country, and particularly as it pertains to the Fourth Estate. Here's what he said about the current state of freedom of the press in this country.
We don't have freedom of the press, for one thing, certainly. You don't have freedom of the press. The big tech has gone wild. And I'm able to get the word out because, you know, I'm able to get it, and then everybody picks it up, including big tech, which is sort of interesting. But other people, I mean, when they get canceled, they don't have that. They can't put out a press release that, you know, everybody picks up. It doesn't work that way. No, you don't have it anymore. You don't have freedom of the press is absolutely gone. And the press is just very dishonest.
And the other freedoms are sure to follow. Jack Phillips, Masterpiece Cake Shop.
Yeah.
The baker from Colorado. He is back in court again.
Why?
He won at the Supreme Court level, but that was for declining to bake a custom cake for a same-sex wedding. Now he is being sued because he wouldn't bake a cake celebrating a gender transition. Same underlying issue. The same business practices. And yet they will never let him alone because the nail that sticks up has to be pounded down.
Well, that's just evil.
Jack Phillips stood by his religious convictions in a rational, sensible, fair-minded, frankly, Christian way. And he beat them, the Jacobins, but they won't relent. And they expect, as is usually the case, that those on the center right, even those with ostensibly deeply held religious beliefs, will relent if you name call them enough, if you harass them enough, if you litigate them enough. I mean, think about how the Little Sisters of the Poor have been treated, much like Jack Phillips, by the Joe Obama administrations. For more on all this, because we better start getting to some young people and deprogramming them, pleased to be joined again by Scott Walker, former governor of Wisconsin, of course, now the president and CEO of Young America's Foundation. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, great to be with you as always. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So Young America's Foundation, under your stewardship, is launching this initiative, this battle plan, if you will, to go after the sort of events that are occurring in our culture that we were just discussing.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, part of the reason when I came in here, when they first asked me if I'd serve as the president of this tremendous organization, the largest conservative organization focused on young people in the country, been around since William F. Buckley, and some of the earliest leaders were Barry Goldwater and eventually Ronald Reagan. Great history, but I just look at all the work that we've done, and I just started as president a few weeks ago, but this great organization has done and said it's not enough. When you hear stories like this, when you see what we're dealing with, we've got to have a long game plan. The left has been at it for decades. They've been taking over our college campuses, and increasingly we see we're under siege in our culture and in our communications with big tech, as President Trump just talked about. And we've got to fight back with a plan that's not just about winning the battle today, but really about the war for the heart and soul of this great republic. And so that's what the long game plan is. It's a 12-point action plan. People want to see every detail of that, then go to yaf.org, yaf.org/long game. And it really lays out our plan to go all the way even into elementary school, and not only for students, but to give the parents the tools they need to reinforce the strength of our founding principles and our Judeo-Christian values.
But it's going to be hard because a lot of conservatives are shamed into silence for fear of, you know, social backlash.
It's the combination of the intimidation factor, which I know something about. I mean, they literally, before calling it cancel culture, they were trying to recall me a decade ago for standing up and putting power back in the hands of the hardworking taxpayers and taking it out of the hands of the union bosses and the other big government special interests that were out there. But it's a combination. On one hand, and you really see it on college campuses, where it's not just left-wing professors, it's these activists that try and shame anybody who's got even a remotely center-right approach. But it's also the other part of it, I think, is conservatives, we put our faith in the people. Radicals, liberals put their faith in the government. And so they're constantly looking for ways to get the government more involved in our lives, whereas we're trying to live our lives. And so that's, again, why you can't just have just solely focus on the battle of the day. There's got to be this long-term, long-game plan. So we're not just winning the battle and then losing sight of all the things the left's trying to do over many decades. We've got to undo it. It's not going to just take a news cycle. It's probably not even going to take just a presidential cycle. We've got to have a long game plan to win back the hearts and minds of the American people, particularly young people.
It's a challenging assessment to make. You know, on the one hand, yes, you always have to play the long game. On the other hand, you have to have a sense of urgency about addressing what's happening in real time. And that raises some difficult decisions. And I bring this up in the context of what you were just referencing, discussing with your plan, and also what Trump had to say about freedom of the press in that podcast. Recent comments by well-respected D.C. Circuit Court Judge Lauren Silberman about the media being dangerous because we're very close to a one-party control of these institutions, and he's suggesting that the Supreme Court should revisit its landmark 1964 New York Times v. Sullivan decision with respect to First Amendment protections for public officials, that maybe, for example, actual malice as the standard for defamation be relaxed. That makes me nervous, even though I agree with the diagnosis. That cure makes me nervous. And it seems to me that's a good example of what I'm trying to get to, which is that tension between the long game but the exigencies of the moment.
Well, we've got to be engaged in both. I mean, for example, we'll go to court if necessary. We've done that successfully even at places like University of California, Berkeley, where they tried to impose, when we brought in Ben Shapiro, these undue burdens with limits on what time it could be. They didn't want to have it after 3 p.m. They didn't want to allow advertising. They wanted to charge these exorbitant security fees that were 3 times more than the left-leaning groups. We went to court in that case and won, and we'll go to court because the Constitution's on our side in any of these cases anywhere in the country. But we'd rather win in the court of public opinion. You know, in the long haul, that's better than, you know, our instinct is not to go to court all the time. And that's where, you know, for example, with big tech, rightfully so, people are understandably concerned. I'm concerned. We've had people on our own team who've been sanctioned on Twitter and Facebook and other places for just ridiculous, out of control, uneven standards that are applied out there. But in cases like that, the answer isn't the federal government coming in and regulating business. The answer in those cases is ultimately, can't happen today, but ultimately, if there's new majorities in the House and the Senate in the future, new leaders in Washington, they should come back and seriously push back on the Section 230 exemptions, but certainly shouldn't add more government to restrict that. Just take away their liability protections if they're going to go from being a platform to being a publisher. But we've got to win those battles right now. We got to engage. We're not giving up on this generation. We're out aggressively working with college students across the nation, and we want to have, for example, one of our points is to have 1 million new participants, to have record numbers of conferences and events, to have speakers in all 50 states for campuses all over the country. But we also have to start sooner with middle school and even elementary school, not only the students, but the parents that want to be involved with this, and even to support some of the teachers. The union bosses are the problem. In most cases, teachers just want to teach, and so for those that do, we're going to give them support just like we give the students support. to be able to teach, you know, things like objective American history and basic economics. We teach that. We're going to do well.
Are you going to have long game chapters in at universities and community colleges and middle schools, and will they let you in?
Well, you know, it's a combination. So for years, YIF has had college chapters. We've started moving into high school. When it comes to middle school, probably less about chapters and more about individual membership and programs. And then when it comes to elementary school, even just getting parents the tools to counter. I'll give you an good example. YIF already has a tip line. In fact, again, if people go to yif.org, in addition to if they do slash the long game, there's another one, yif.org/tips. And you'd be amazed as to all the things. You can see it. You can pick your states, Illinois, Wisconsin, any other state in the country, and see the things we're looking into. We got a tip from students at Iowa State. So it wasn't even just about the campus. We all the time hear about crazy left-wing professors. We hear about ridiculous ideas that just a few years ago we would never imagine of segregating students based on race or income or other things. But this the example in Iowa State was about the Ames School District. So the government-run school district last month for the first week of February had a BLM week of action where they started in kindergarten, went through 12th grade, and they gave kindergartners coloring pages about transgender individuals and said they could pick their sex. This is for kindergartners with coloring pages. The curriculum then throughout the grades even talked about how fathers aren't necessarily needed in the family structure. These are radical indoctrination efforts that we're going to expose, and not just expose, but push back on, and then give parents and students the tools to counter them. You know, they're teaching our students to hate America. They're teaching this here that somehow the founders were just these horrible, awful people. And we're going to counter that by telling about the fundamentals of our founding principles, our Judeo-Christian values, the things that have made this country great and will be going forward. We've got to counter that or we're going to lose a whole nother wave of a generation.
All right. Quick question before we let you go on Wisconsin, because we want it to be a safer haven for fleeing Illinoisans than it currently is under Governor Evers. Is your buddy Ryan Priebus going to run for governor, number one? And number two, is Ron Johnson going to run for reelection?
Well, I think those two go together. If Ron doesn't run, I wouldn't be surprised if Reince doesn't think seriously about running for the U.S. Senate, because that's where his expertise would be. You know, he's loving life in the private sector. If he doesn't run, Sean Duffy probably runs for the Senate seat if Ron doesn't. Either way, I'm almost 100% certain that Rebecca Clayfish, who was lieutenant governor for 8 years under me, will run, and she'd be spectacular. She joined me, and she and I were the only two governor and lieutenant governor in American history to survive a recall election. So she's been tested as well. But Reince will be in the mix one way or the other.
Very good. All right. Appreciate nice the insights. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, now the president and CEO of Young America's Foundation. And again, the long game plan and your engagement with YAF, Young America's Foundation, YAF.org. Scott, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Have a great one. Keep fighting for freedom. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yep. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, caller two, in reaction to our conversation with former Wisconsin governor, current Young America's Foundation president, Scott Walker. Bill in Evergreen Park.
Yeah, you know, talking about Reince Priebus, us true defenders of liberty spotted around the country, you know, we haven't forgotten what Reince did as the head of the Republican Party in Tampa in 2012 to Ron Paul. You know, these are the kind of guys we want gone from...
Can you remind us what happened, please?
Well, Ron Paul was going to speak because he actually had enough support to get on the platform at the Republican convention in Tampa. And when he wanted to do his speech, and Reince Priebus says, not until we vet it, and Ron Paul told him to pound sand.
Yeah.
We haven't forgotten it.
If you go back and look, there was a, you know, sort of a making up between Ron Paul and Reince Priebus and their respective forces, if you will. I hear you. I mean, I know there were people that weren't ecstatic about Priebus during his time as RNC chairman, even during his time as Trump's chief of staff and so forth. But it'd be interesting if he runs for Senate, if Ron Johnson doesn't, I suspect he'll get Trump's backing, and if he runs for governor, I don't know if Sean Duffy would run or not, because Sean Duffy obviously is a Trump loyalist too. So that could be really interesting.
I think you can be a Trump loyalist. I think you can, you know, really enjoy the good things Trump did for this country and not be part of the, you know, if the swamp creatures really like to slyly attach themselves. You guys know this.
Yeah, I know.
So I'll listen.
Yeah,
thanks
for the call. But I mean, look, it's fair to raise the concerns, especially for somebody who's been sort of Republican Party reptile for a long time in Reince Priebus, who I generally like, particularly because he came up with Scott Walker, who we were just talking to, and they're tight. But yeah, I mean, you know, always have to be on guard. Always have to be on guard. That's a fair point that Bill raises.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and of course, much discussion about Joe Biden canceling the Keystone Pipeline and costing 11,000 people their jobs. Less attention to the other policies in this vein that need to be discussed, recognized, assessed. Biden last week canceled the sale of 80 million acres of Gulf of Mexico oil leases that was scheduled for last week, Wednesday, in New Orleans. Mike Moncla, president of the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association, said it would kill our state. It would kill workers. It would kill jobs. It would be a terrible thing. These nearly 250,000 Louisiana residents work in the oil and gas industry. 98,000 of them have offshore jobs. But you recall Biden banned all new oil and gas leases on public land and waters for 60 days in an executive order that he inked on January 20th, the day he took office. So the carnage potentially continues, depending on what ultimately the administration's position will be on those leases. Now, the flip side is, I learned this morning, we played this for you last hour, Katie Hevener is a second grade school teacher at Polaris Charter Academy in Chicago. And she read us all the book AS for Activists, which I'm shocked has not been a National Book Award winner yet. And she explained, provided some context for the new alphabet, the Maoist alphabet that our kids are being taught. S is for solar, but, you know, please listen to Katie's explanation of solar there. Don't just, not just the rhyme in the Maoist book, but her subsequent explanation.
S is for sun, sol, solar. Superstar, stellar power, fuels all life, not just flowers. Energized homes, cars, and showers. Silly, selfish scoundrels, sucking on dinosaur sludge. Boo, hiss. So for this one, it's saying that the sun is our best source of power. So you can move to electric power, or you can, like, solar power, and collect all your power from the sun, just like plants do. So it's not just for the plants, it can be for us too. Because a lot of our power right now comes from gasoline. And gasoline comes from the earth. And basically what that is very, very, very old dinosaur bones that have been mashed down and turned into sludge that turns into oil. And that oil is what we put in our cars, and we use it to fuel a lot of things in our country. And so this page is saying, instead of using all that stuff that's in the ground that's going to run out pretty soon, we could just use the sun, because the sun's not going to run out.
Whew. Oh, boy.
I don't think she's got quite the science right or a handle on the amount of natural resources available. But you know what? That is not dissimilar from some of the positions you hear AOC and the Socialist Spice Girls or the Democrat Socialist Party writ large taking. So I guess it's as meritorious as any. For a reaction to that, pleased to be joined by Alex Epstein, founder of the Center for Industrial Progress, author of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. What? And blogs at energytalkingpoints.com. Alex, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you just heard from a licensed educator redefining the alphabet for us that solar power is where it's at, then we don't have to take that yucky stuff out of the ground.
Yeah, so it wasn't quite accurate. I mean, one way to think about fossil fuels, you know, just talking about dinosaurs, it's not really from dinosaurs, but what it is from is it's ancient solar power. So it's plants that grew millions and millions of years ago, and nature has concentrated them and stored them into something that we can, at low cost, transform into usable energy that can power planes and cargo ships and produce electricity and do everything else. And the fact is that there's really nothing in the world right now that's nearly as good as these fossil fuels at producing low-cost, on-demand electricity and other forms of energy for billions of people. The closest is nuclear, which is also a naturally concentrated and stored source of energy. And what's interesting is that the people who claim that they are concerned about global warming are also the biggest advocates of nuclear, even though that's by far the most promising ultimate replacement for fossil fuels that doesn't emit CO2.
And so the policies that the Biden administration has pursued so far, the much publicized cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline, but also the cancellation of these leases I mentioned at the outset, if the administration continues in that policy direction, what are the implications?
Yeah, there are several really bad implications. I mean, in general, when you restrict energy production, what happens is the price of energy goes up, the reliability goes down, and that means the cost of everything goes up. And if you're talking about, I mean, energy disruption is particularly damaging. I mean, one consequence is it doesn't just destroy jobs in the energy industry, it destroys jobs in every other industry. If you look at, say, the U.S. compared to China, their industrial electricity use is already five times what ours is, and ours is stagnating, in part because our prices have been increased thanks to a lot of addition of solar and wind, which doesn't replace the fossil fuels. It just adds to the cost of fossil fuels because they always need the backup. And so, I mean, that's just one of many, many negative implications, is that our industry gets harmed. And already it's been harmed by this solar and wind, which China doesn't use nearly as much of. And they produce our solar and wind mostly with their coal. So, yeah, if this continues, it's tremendously destructive to even just our industrial economy. And there are many, many other consequences, such as higher consumer prices, huge declines in national security as our economy tanks and as we become more dependent on foreign countries for energy.
But Biden and his spokesperson there, Jen Psaki, say, it's job loss on the front end, but it's going to be job gains on the back end, all the green jobs that are coming online that those who were working on the Keystone Pipeline can get. We're just in a transitionary period. And once we make that transition, it's going to be milk and honey.
Right. You mentioned this website, energytalkingpoints.com, where people, if they want a lot of detail on this, they can look at that. But just three big points about the green jobs. So there's no way this will work because the green jobs are far less productive. They're largely based in China. And as I mentioned just now, they cause job losses in other industries because they cause skyrocketing energy prices. Look, if this stuff were actually good, it could compete on a free market. So you wouldn't need to get rid of pipelines. You wouldn't need to stop these projects. You just need to let everyone free. Why don't they do that? Because they know on some level that these things aren't remotely competitive. In fact, they have huge subsidies and mandates right now. You look at the situation in Texas. Why is it that Texas is shutting down a lot of their reliable electricity capacity, particularly nuclear and coal? Like, why are they on that trajectory? And there's more and more solar and wind. We saw in these blackouts that solar and wind totally did not produce anything, and they wouldn't have even if there had been no turbines, just because the sun and the wind don't cooperate with when you need energy. And yet, why are they being used so much? Because of so many different subsidies and mandates. So they're already given huge favors, and they're already causing huge costs and reliability problems. And so Biden, by forcing them down our throats, this is not a transition in the sense of an evolution. It's a transition in the sense of a regression. So it's really unfortunately, this administration is a very regressive administration where they're going to take us back, not forward.
And so how do you react when you hear politicians like Gavin Newsom declare that by 2035, California will be electric car only? I mean, you can incentivize automakers to make electric cars only by subsidizing them. But the energy production is still a whole nother matter. So that how the electricity is produced to power the new and exciting electric fleets is another matter.
Yeah, exactly. So electric car is not the same as solar powered car, because you have to ask, well, how are the materials being mined? How are they being processed? Where is the manufacturing happening? And that's mostly fossil fueled. So yeah, even if you did have just battery cars by 2035, it would be overwhelmingly produced by fossil fuels. I live in California, and so if you look at what's happening with our electricity policy, is we're forcing more and more of what I call these unreliables, this unreliable solar and wind. Now that's already causing us huge problems. And just to give an indication of how unrealistic some of these things are, California has just contracted for a large amount of new natural gas electricity supply this summer to avoid the blackouts last summer. If you look at charts, I've posted this on, if you look at twitter.com/AlexEpstein, I posted, I think last week, you know, last summer during the heat wave, Los Angeles was overwhelmingly powered by coal from other states. So it's just a total farce that these things are competitive. Really what they are is they're parasites on the reliable sources of energy. But what Biden is trying to do is he's trying to mandate the parasites, and that can only lead to disaster.
And I don't know what it's like in California, but Illinois gas prices jumped about 60 cents a gallon within the past few weeks. How bad is it up there?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, well over $4 in different places here. And you just look at that, so that's bad. But you think about, well, what Biden is advocating is he wants it to be completely unaffordable. He wants it to be illegal. So you think about, well, yeah, it's bad to have $4 a gallon gasoline, but imagine having EVs at California prices with California and Texas reliability. Like, that's much worse than $4 a gallon. So they want to prevent it. They want to make gasoline prohibitively expensive, and ultimately they want to outlaw it.
E is for EnergyTalkingPoints.com. That's the website for information to provide some response to the shibboleths you're hearing from the Biden administration. He is Alex Epstein, founder of the Center for Industrial Progress, author of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, and again, blogger at EnergyTalkingPoints.com. Alex, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, technology's done it again.
What this time? What do we have?
Yahoo Life reporting. Most of the time, individuals catch their cheating partners via emails, text messages, social media platforms, especially if they've already disclosed passwords and such, right? Now, Fitbit can nab you. Nadia Essex is a British reality TV host, and she explained what happened to her.
How many of you knew your relationship was over?
Oh, honey, I got a doozy. So when my ex-boyfriend came home from a night out, I woke up in the morning and thought, let me make him some breakfast, and I got a notification on my Fitbit. The Fitbit that we'd synced together, that between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning last morning, he had burned over 500 calories.
Oh no, he did. Oh no.
So I shot that breakfast where the sun doesn't shine, darling.
Darling, she's very colorful. He could have been doing wind sprints, early morning wind sprints.
Yeah, with Jussie Smollett running to the Subway shop to get a tuna sandwich.
Carpe diem. He's out there seizing the day. Maybe somebody a flat tire. Maybe he's fighting crime. He's taking de Blasio's wife's advice to intercede when he sees...
be vigilante.
Yeah, vigilante justice out
there.
Yeah,
for an hour.
Did
you hear what Tinder's doing? You know, that ghastly dating app? It's more like a hookup app.
If you say so.
Well, I'm sure. What's the gay one? Bender?
Is that you're trying to get me to say it?
I don't know.
Oh, well, how do you know?
Right. I don't know.
Grindr is the other one.
Grindr. Okay.
I read a lot.
No, that's fine. You gotta know what's going on.
I know what Tinder is.
Yeah.
Too.
So Tinder now is handing out free COVID tests that you could take at home and then send back after you have a hookup on Tinder. Isn't that? They're so caring about their. Because they're not just, you know, reading books I don't think it's a COVID. Cards.
I don't think it's a COVID test you need after a hookup on Tinder.
Well, COVID is kind of like a sexually transmitted disease, too, if you think about it. If you make out with somebody and they have it, then...
I want to stop thinking about it.
Okay. Fine.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.